Welcome to TNT's Hit Songs from Mars, where we unravel the stories behind some of pop's most unlikely hits.
From simple curiosities to songs that changed the world, we examine the socio-political and cultural factors that contributed to the success of these surprising outliers.
And the impact these songs had on society. I'm Tom Thompson.
And I'm Tyler Ralston. And together we're
TNT.
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
I'm good. You can open your eyes now.
Okay, it's good.
This is my WKRP in Cincinnati look that I'm
Dr. Johnny Fever. Today. Yeah, it's good. Those are the precise glasses that he wore, aren't they?
I don't know. I remember buying a lot of glasses at a garage sale, like probably 20 years ago, and I brought them in to work, and everyone just... wore them at work. It was pretty funny.
Yeah, that's definitely reminiscent of Johnny Fever.
Yeah, good.
I think he just died recently too, didn't he, the actor?
I think he did just die recently.
Johnny, can't think of his name. I want to say Weissmuller, but it's not that.
He was Tarzan. Where did you come up with that name?
Oh, he was Tarzan like way back in the 40s.
Okay. How's it going?
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good.
I guess you're winding up your school year.
Today, I just gave my last class of the semester.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, I'd still got all the grading and stuff to do. Marking for our Canadian audience to do. But other than that.
Isn't grading something you do to like soil or something like that?
It is. Yeah, but you know, words sometimes have two meanings. As your nonstop series of innuendos and insinuations indicate.
You know, I have to say I'm loving this look with the glasses. I think I'm going to do this every single time.
Oh,
maybe I'll be like Elton John and I'll have a different set of glasses every time.
I'd go for it, man. Just be the guy who never takes off his glasses.
Yes. I like that.
Yeah, it's good. It's a good look.
I think, as you know, I had the honor of opening for the mighty Kim Mitchell last week. Which was incredible.
Did you have to light the patio lanterns or did he have his own crew?
No, luckily I didn't have to. His crew did that, yeah.
That was nice.
It was pretty awesome. I wasn't really sure what the Kim Mitchell fans were going to think of us, but...
So you made it through how many songs before you got booed off the stage?
We made it through seven. No. No, they were super... It was very... like one of the nicest receptions I've ever seen, even from... people who are our fans, like to have a bunch of people that didn't know us receive us so well was pretty amazing.
Good positive vibe then.
Yeah. And I mean, I've played bigger, like, you know, I've played the main stage on big festivals, but never to like 800, 900 people attentively listening. So it was really something. It was pretty incredible.
How was Kim Mitchell?
He was great. He was great. I mean, he's a hell of a guitar player.
Yeah, you can hear it.
Oh, yeah. He's good. His guitar playing is still great. He can still sing well. And he still had his side person there, Peter Fredette, I think is his name, who sang all the high, you know, all those high parts and songs like, I don't know, All We Are. I think he sings a lot on that one. So he was still there and he plays bass and guitar. And it was a really awesome night.
Yeah, there's one that uniquely Canadian. He never broke into the American scene.
He didn't, eh? I was going to ask you that.
No.
If he did or not.
Maybe in the 80s, you know, some real guitar rockers would know Gopher Soda or something along those lines.
Right.
But he never made it in. Most, I mean, a lot don't. It's kind of that may be for another, like, you know, I wanted to say the Guess Who, but that's definitely one that did. Yeah. The Tragically Hip, that's the one I was trying to look for.
I was actually just going to ask you about that.
The New Orleans Is Sinking was a minor hit around 1992, and that is it.
is muddy. What's this river that I'm in? New Orleans is sinking, man, and I don't want to swim.
Bare Naked Ladies got bigger with If I Had $1 Million. You know, just that was one you heard quite a bit. But the phenomenon surrounding the Tragically Hip, it's something that if you didn't kind of witness it, it's like that doesn't make any sense. I mean, There's a generation that band spoke for, it seems.
For sure. Never particularly me, but I actually did like – I preferred their more acoustic songs. And actually, some of their later stuff I really enjoyed. What about Blue Rodeo? Did they,
as far as I know,
wave?
Nothing.
I mean, Blue Rodeo is so quintessentially Canadian that it kind of makes sense to me that they wouldn't necessarily translate to an American audience.
They met in a hurricane, standing in the shelter out of the rain. She tucked a note into his hand. Later on, they took his car. He wrote her name in the sand. Never even let go.
And I think that's the deal with the Tragically Hip, too. They were Canadians who sang about Canadian things, and I think that's why, in part, it caught on so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, a unique kind of thing. I'm not sure it still carries the same cachet among younger people, but...
Yeah. You know, something just occurred to me that part of the reason why some of these acts never really broke out in the U.S. is because they were so big in Canada and used to playing their own shows that they would refuse, you know what I mean? Like they wouldn't want to go on tour with another band that was bigger in the U.S. You know what I mean? Because maybe they're like, oh, well, we're used to selling out 15,000, you know, seat concert halls. Why would we go on tour with Lenny Kravitz or something like that? You know what I mean? So that might have something to do with it.
And I think also there might be a certain, you break into the American scene and it's kind of a kiss of death where now the ticker is clicking for when you kind of become passé, where you could theoretically milk it forever in your home country. Of Canada, it's
right
because bands like Kim Mitchell, yeah, such longevity among the fan base.
Yeah, and I mean, people at the show, they were just fanatical. I mean, they it was amazing to see the level of fandom.
Far out. Well, what do you got for us today?
Well, Ty, let me tell you, I had quite a few options on the table,
and
I had kind of a hard time deciding which one to do. But, you know, interestingly, I've been thinking about some lately that I really despise that will once probably make it onto the show. But I wasn't feeling like in a despising, despicable type mood today to be just kind of going on about what a stupid song this was. So I'll save those for another time. I'm not sure what the right mood is for that. Maybe, I don't know, when we've had a few beverages, perhaps might be the...
Yeah, we've never beverageized right on our show yet.
That's true.
Other than tea, which we've discussed at length.
Well, interesting you should say that about tea because I haven't had my afternoon tea yet, so I'm a bit of a
You're
disadvantage.
You're going to get a little bitchy
here.
With us?
Possibly. And
right.
you'll see why it's very unfortunate in a moment that I have not had my tea. All right.
So there's something related to tea with the upcoming song.
That's it.
Well, all right.
Sort of.
Okay.
Here we go.
Sister's sighing in her sleep. Brother's got a date to keep, he can't hang around.
Alright. Our house.
In the middle of our street, our house.
You got this one? You're pretty familiar.
Yeah, that's definitely a memorable mega hit from the era.
Very, very odd, isn't it?
And I can't remember if it's on my list or not. It might be one that we end up having in common.
Okay, well, before we get into it, I'll tell you a little bit about this song. First of all, it's Our House by Madness, obviously, as you know. And Madness was originated in Camden Town, North London, and they started in 1976 at that beautiful time to be in London, the punk rock scene, just taking off and all that jazz. And this, you know, they're a ska band, right? They were kind of like I guess I would say the main four ska bands from that era.
Specials, English Beat, although they differ significantly in Madness. What's the fourth one you're thinking of?
I would probably say the Selector.
Okay.
Which is definitely lesser known than those three. So this song was released in 82 and
kind of at the end of their run, wasn't it?
No. Well, actually, they're still playing apparently. They've kind of been on and off members coming and going, obviously. They've still been going. I mean, I haven't really been following them, to be honest. It was certainly the earlier days that I was most interested in. The song went to number 5 in the UK, number 7 in the US on the Billboard charts, and number 1 in Canada.
Canadians really took to it.
It was definitely a big thing in Canada. And I guess what I find interesting about this song, and actually not just this song, is there, I'm going to put a question to you here. Is there something unique about British music where I could be totally wrong about this, but it occurs to me that the Brits are always talking about sort of just commonplace things more than any other country that I've ever noticed, where weirdly, the only comparison I can have is to like country, where it's just kind of, you know, I went down to the, you know, but it's interesting because if you think about, and I would say particularly in this era in 82, you think about, you know, Our House, it's like, first of all, what a weird song to become a hit in, I mean, it makes sense in Britain, right? Because it's just kind of like a working class British ditty, and it's a good song, obviously. It's catchy. But you know, why would it do so well in the US and Canada? And then when you think about this era, like if you think of some other songs, it's funny, interesting, exactly around that time, obviously one of my favorites, The Jam, also 1982, A Town Called Malice came out. And I was just thinking about all these British songs where it's just kind of like about day-to-day struggles, mostly of working class people. And I can't think of any other country that's, if you look at the other songs at that time, it's such a different thing. No one's, Billy Bragg, obviously, he was one. I mean, he was more politically
oriented,
but,
right.
But you know what I mean? Isn't that interesting?
You could add to that list, same year, if I'm not mistaken, the Kinks' Come Dancing. It's, you know, multi-generational, you know, dance hall. It's now a parking lot. Same kind of everyday kind of thing.
Yeah.
They put a parking lot on a piece of land where the supermarket used to stand. Before that, they put up a bowling alley on the site that used to be the local pally. That's where the big band used to come and play. My sister went there on a Saturday, come dancing. All her boyfriends used to come and call. Why not come dancing? Sonny Natural.
I can remember those songs kind of being played. You know, if I listened to a lot of radio at that time, those songs were both always on.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting point. I'd have to think about it.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, the United States, we talk about commonplace stuff, you know, start coming up with examples, but it's an interesting point.
Yeah.
Something that worthy of, pursuing.
Well, it just occurred to me actually this morning when I was listening to these songs and I was just thinking about all of these songs from, not all of them, but so many British songs and how commonplace the subject matter is.
Okay, I can think of one to balance it out. ZZ Top's Legs. You know, most people have legs. So, I mean, right off the bat, so I'm going to have to challenge your supposition.
Right. I'm an idiot. I noticed that I think the big hit around that era was Up Where We Belong.
Yeah, it was a theme from An Officer and a Gentleman mega hit, right?
Yeah, huge hit. But I mean, if you like, this is just so out of left field compared to that.
Yeah, I got to ponder this point, Tom. It's an intriguing, we have to do a serious study in terms of what people are singing about at a given time and a given place. That's definitely a good point. This is kind of where it gets, a big hit. But the thing is, Madness is Our House is not your typical Madness song either.
Mm-hmm.
It's more, it moves away from the it's not that, you know, standard ska beat. It's much more radio play oriented.
Mm-hmm.
You almost wouldn't even call it ska. It's influence, but it has, you know, you wouldn't just jump out and say that was ska. It's a ska band.
I agree. If they hadn't had a ska background, you know what I mean? You wouldn't hear anything of ska in there, I don't think, really.
Right. And if you listen to Madness's greatest hits, that one's an anomaly, even though it's probably their biggest hit.
Mm-hmm.
But this is where it gets kind of weird, interesting, however you want to look at it. One of their biggest hits, you know, in the UK, probably Canada as well, not the US, was one called Baggy Trousers.
Yeah.
Which is a very typical ska kind of beat in mm-hmm. the whole bit. Nice, nice tune, too. Mm-hmm. Naughty boys in nasty schools, headmasters breaking all the rules, having fun and playing pools, smashing up the woodwork tools. All the teachers in the pub, passing around a ready rap, trying not to think of when that lunchtime bell will ring. But where they were most influential, oddly enough, was they inspired a television commercial in the United States that's based on Baggy Trousers.
Okay.
But yet Baggy Trousers never became a hit. It was the Colgate pump. You remember that one?
No.
She's got the Colgate pump. We've got the Colgate pump. And it was all Brit mod kids dancing around their house, excited about the new Colgate pump.
I don't know if that made it to Canada.
Well, maybe there was some sense of decency north of the border. I'm not sure. But no, but the thing is, there were two commercials. One was in Britain. Mm-hmm. It was the Colgate pump.
Okay.
And the Colgate pump I know what it was. The Colgate pump just never made it to Canada at that point. You guys were still dealing with alum or whatever things for toothpaste. It's just behind the times.
That's true.
I get it.
That's
so they weren't selling pumpkins. Colgate pumps. Yeah, they weren't selling Colgate pumps in Canada. So obviously you can't have the commercial unless, you know, I can envision you calling me up as a kid telling you to bring you the Colgate pump because of the commercial. But it was this catchy thing. Like they would kind of do this squat, stand, dance.
So they stole that from the act, because they did that, right? The Madness did that. That was the thing they did.
But it was, you could take the music from Baggy Trousers, put the lyrics for the Colgate pump over the lyrics, and it's frickin' the same thing. Even moms and dads agree what makes it great is MFP. You know, like maximum fluoride protection. So here we're doing our plug. If you can find a Colgate pump today, the thing didn't work. It just got jammed up with crud and hardened toothpaste.
Well, there you go. We weren't so dumb up here in Canada, were we? We just didn't bother with that crap.
You didn't get the Colgate pumps. You didn't have the option to be dumb. There you go. We worked through it. We worked through the pump, and then we worked back to very environmentally unfriendly toothpaste tubes, and that's where we are today.
Yeah, way to go. Well done.
Yeah, these tubes you roll up apparently will last, you know, into the next era of beings after the, you know, two
yeah,
more.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
But the whole people were intrigued with this commercial, intrigued with that mod scene, but it never really caught on except for our house. Hmm. And of course, people listened to ska and things like that, but that was a tiny, tiny sliver of the population.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if people just never looked any further to find out that it was Madness. You know what I mean? Like, they're like, oh, cool song, but they just assumed it was made for the commercial or something, maybe. I don't know.
I don't think anyone had a clue that there was a song called Baggy Trousers out there. But in England, they obviously did.
Yeah.
And I remember there's a redheaded kid in both videos. It's the same kid.
Okay.
And at one point, he tried to... In YouTube, when this stuff gets reemerged about 10 years ago, he's like, hey, I'm the ginger in both of these commercials. And I guess they were done a little differently, I guess to appeal to different audiences and things like that.
Okay.
So anyway, that's there's a little bit of Madness trivia for you.
Yeah, that's good. Well, I think one of the songs probably, yeah, their songs are all over the place. And they're pretty weird, a lot of them. But what obviously
Night
the
Boat
one
to Cairo comes to mind.
Yeah, that's weird. And I can't remember the name of the one I was listening to this morning. That one cardiac arrest is interesting too. Talking about like commonplace things.
Papers in the morning, bowler hat on head, walking to the bus stop, he's longing for his bed. Waiting with his neighbours in the rush hour queue. Got to get the first bus, so much for him to do. He's got to hurry, got to get his seat. Can't miss his place, got to rest his feet.
But obviously One Step Beyond was a big, you know, that was like a ska anthem for them. You know,
that's
you
a
must
great
know that
tune.
One. Yeah. But I don't think, it's not, there's no singing really at all. It's mostly instrumental with just the...
One step beyond.
Yeah.
One step
But it's interesting because I was listening to a podcast a while ago. I kind of went on a weird kick with ska stuff, and I was listening to a whole history of the two-tone records. And I think one of the things that I didn't realize is how important the two-tone record label was in terms of integrating white and black musicians together at that time. I kind of thought that at that time, you know, this would no longer be an issue, but apparently, it was pretty radical that they had whites and blacks playing, in the same band, and the whole two-tone movement was pretty, pretty amazing. Yeah.
If you watch the video for, Oh, geez, which one would it be? One of the special songs might be Gangsters. It might be Message to You, Rudy. Mm-hmm. I can't remember, but
I love those.
Let's
videos.
Just say the video makes it a vit. What is it?
I love those. Message to You, Rudy is such a great video. It's just, I mean, it's just them playing, but it's all the white and black, and their clothes are amazing, and they're dancing. It's so cool.
Stop your messing around. Better think of your future. Time you straighten right out. Creating problems in town. Oh, Rudy. A message to you, Rudy.
Well, in one of their videos, they make it a pretty flagrant point. I mean, they're making a hint with a hammer. It's like, hey, we are a dual racial band here.
Mm-hmm.
Making a hint with a hammer, really. But nevertheless, perhaps the hint needed to be made.
I think it did. Yeah.
In Britain, curiously enough, though, I mean, here's a real outlier in a sense. I mean, the Allman Brothers, a decade earlier in the U.S. South, had an integrated band.
Okay.
Two black guys were in the band.
Uh-huh.
And so that's kind of like a real shocker in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, the issues of racism and things like that. I mean, you got, as again, you said it's a great time to be in London in 1976, 1977 or whatever in terms of music. Yeah. But in terms of economy, yeah. It was falling apart. Again, yeah. That bad economy fuels punk rock.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And oh, they love to lay into Margaret Thatcher. I mean, it was almost a requirement. You had to have an anti-Thatcher song. I mean, the special sang, I don't want to stay on Maggie's farm no more.
Oh, yeah.
The Dylan song.
Yeah.
Stand down, Margaret, stand down, please.
Yeah.
So it was required. You had to have, you know, something like that to talk. Oh, the best song that just kind of nails it is Ghost Town.
Oh yeah,
talking about, you know, the violence. Everyone's tense. It's, you know, and then, you know, tribalism with race and you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, those early special stuff were pretty darn
incredible.
Yeah.
This place is coming like a ghost town. Bands won't play no more. Too much fighting on the dance floor.
And it's interesting because, you know, that Elvis Costello produced the first specials record. And this is totally just a hypothesis and I have nothing to back this up, but my sense of it was that they got him in, or someone got him in, and to basically just get out of the way and let them do what they do. Because I mean, there's certainly nothing in there that resembles Elvis Costello or his type of production or anything like that. It's super raw. You know, my sense is that maybe he recognized, like, someone, you know, there's these moments, right, where you hear people talk about this a lot, especially in terms of like punk rock and things like that, where, you know, a band suddenly they play these live shows and then they get a record deal and they're kind of on a big label or something. And then there's someone sometimes who's smart enough to be like, we just have to make sure we don't wreck what they do. You know what I mean? Like, all we want to do is as best as we can is to capture the essence of what a live show from that band is like, you know? And I'm totally just guessing about this, but I have this weird feeling that they were kind of like, oh, Elvis Costello, he gets it and he won't mess around with us or try to polish us or anything like that. It's just it's a hypothesis.
Right. In the production on that first album is, it's pretty raw.
It's very raw.
If I remember correctly.
It also sounds great. So, I mean, you know what I mean? It, Well, it's funny actually, because if you listen to it from song to song, they sound completely different. The production is completely different. Some sound almost like a live recording, and some are much higher production values, which is interesting too. And I don't actually think it matters. You know, these days you would be like, oh, that sounds so out of place or whatever. But I think it just kind of suited that band and that era, you know?
Yeah, I'd put that album easy top 10 of all time on
my list.
It's
so good. It is so good. Every time I listen to it, I can't believe how good it is. How many good songs there are on that.
One right after another.
Yeah. I saw the specials in the 90s in Ottawa. And Terry Hall was not in the band.
Okay.
And I thought that I was kind of worried that it might not be that great, but it was incredible. It was unbelievable. Like the energy was there and it was just amazing. And it's really funny because I remember I was standing with a guy from a band, I believe they're called Watercan, and they were playing, we played with them a little bit back in the day. And they were playing the next night at this club, the Penguin in Ottawa. And at one point, the singer from the specials put the microphone down his pants. and then my buddy looks over and he goes, looks like I'm bringing my own mic tomorrow. That's
fair enough.
Yeah. But it was pretty amazing. You know, obviously the English Beat was incredible too.
Different sound altogether. They had very distinctive sounds. You wouldn't confuse one for the other.
Yeah.
I guess the specials had that. They kept the beat the most, you know, ska-ish, I guess you could say.
Yeah, for sure.
English Beat, a little more going on in terms of different kinds of things. Madness sort of would be the most publicly accessible, I guess you could say, the most listener-friendly, PG-rated type stuff.
I always found them a little bit too zany for me.
Like they zany's were, they a good
was
word.
A little bit goofy, and which is why I don't think I ever liked them as much as the specials or the English Beat. There was just something kind of goofy about them, and it was okay, but definitely
it was lighthearted.
Yeah, exactly.
And whereas the specials could be very heavy hitting, in ways that maybe didn't even work for them. I don't know. I mean, the band evolved a lot over the run that it had.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. What did you think about the sort of, because there was another kind of revival, because this, I mean, in the 70s and early 80s, this was a ska revival, you know? It wasn't
right.
It wasn't the first wave of ska.
No, Skatalites were like early 60s, you know, that pre-reggae ska.
Yeah. Obviously, there was a third wave, ska wave, you know, I mean, you can't really say No Doubt is really ska, but they incorporated that. And that, in the early days, it was part of what, and you know, the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, bands
right.
like that. And when I was listening to this little doc about Two Tone, I actually loved hearing even the No Doubt song that had kind of like it's actually pretty heavily ska influenced, the early stuff.
I remember that third wave, and I remember, like, you know, college bands would do a lot of ska stuff and things like that.
Yeah. There was a band from Montreal called Me, Mom, and Morgenthaler.
Okay, good name.
They were incredible. But they were sort of really weird ska. Like, really, like ska, but they were strange, strange, strange. Just an amazing live show, though.
I don't want to be your friend. I don't want to be your friend.
I got to check this out.
Yeah, they were fantastic. But there's, yeah, there's, I'm trying to think of some of the other bands. It's, at a point, it kind of got a little bit too mixed up with hardcore, I think. And it interested me less.
Can you think of an example?
I don't know. It's just like the guitars got too heavy and it just didn't suit. I just didn't think it suited that little ka-chunk, ka-chunk offbeat thing.
Yeah, the guitar is kind of a, yeah, it's a rhythm instrument in ska, secondary.
Yeah, kind the of, bass well, is very melodic. That bass player in the Specials, holy cow, he's good.
Sir, what's his name? Sir Roger Gentleman or something like that.
I don't.
Yeah, it's
think
so. It's some off the wall name.
In, Sir in the guy's Gentleman.
Something like that. Yeah. Okay. And his, and of course, you know, he's, I think, you know, you see him and he's got, he's missing front row of teeth and everything. Just total irony.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess there was a real split in the band between those that wanted to go more mainstream and those that did not. And the band split into the Specials sort of Mark II and then Fun Boy III, which pretty much went absolutely nowhere.
Oh, yeah, and then the Fine Young Cannibals, that was all English beat. And they were huge, right?
Oh, they had those
massive.
They had a couple of very, very big hits. Like, you know, that would 89 or 90, can't remember, but yeah, She Drives Me Crazy would have been the song of the year that year, practically.
Yeah, absolutely.
Realize they were the leftovers of the English beat.
I think the I could be wrong, but I think it's the guitar player and the bass player formed it. And I think they were pretty they're a pretty big part of the English beat sound, I think.
Well, yeah, and I guess there's a point where you would move on from it and maybe or end the experiment and the band or something like that, because there would finally be a limit if you're gonna boom chuck for all eternity. And it's like, yeah, let's move on from this.
Yeah, it would become very tiresome for sure. You could see why they'd want to move on from it. Yeah, definitely. Why do you think a song like this would be like what how does it appeal to? It's just such a, to me, it's such a quintessentially British song that you would think that only Brits would really get and be able to identify with. And I'm just kind of curious what you think about why a song like this would have international appeal.
Good question.
Like, is it almost like a novelty thing? Like, it's funny, kind of? It's a little bit goofy?
All of the above, yeah. I would say. But, I mean, that was a big hit. Well, you said it went to number 7 in the States.
Yeah.
I'd be real curious as what the 6 above it were. I would have guessed it would have gone to number 1.
Yeah.
Don't forget, this is the early 80s. This is the era of the quirky tune, where everyone just loved, you know, a little weird, but not too weird. You know, the new wave kind of stuff, Flock of Seagulls, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So it really kind of fits in with its era to a large extent.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just, you know, to write a song about one's house. I mean, it's, internationally, I guess that's something pretty much everyone can relate to.
Well, that's true.
Can relate to it.
That's true. And the sentiment of it is kind of sweet. It's kind of like talking about simpler times, being a kid in a busy working class house where, you know, it's kind of interesting because I was rereading the lyrics and there was a little bit of a hint at one point that the dad wasn't so great in this story.
Remind
and
the
mom
line.
Was kind of, I can't remember exactly, but
father wears his Sunday best.
Yeah, there's something about I can't remember, but there was a little time. There's just one line where it was like, oh, maybe mom's running the show here and dad's not. He's drinking too many lagers or something like that.
Father gets up late for work. Mother has to iron his shirt. Then she sends the kids to school. Sees them off with a small kiss. They're going to miss in lots of ways.
But if you listen to the full song, like the album version, the very last line in it, something tells you that you've got to get away from it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And you never hear that in the radio version, except very, very rarely.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a hint of everything not being perfect. I mean, I think the sentiment of the song is just kind of like everyday life, and we take the good and we take the bad, and you know, but definitely there's a little hint of like, yeah, we got to get out of here.
or perhaps, you know, the childhood can't last forever. You got to move on.
Yeah. Well, that that's probably more accurate actually. I find that one thing that the Brits do really well is I like the way they mix drama and comedy so effectively together. Americans are terrible at it because it's either a drama or it's a comedy, and you cannot mix them in terms of Hollywood, I would say. Like, it's just...
Can you think of an example that just...
Well, no, they just don't even try. Like, it's either a comedy or it's a drama, and they do... I mean, I just think back to some films where... They get you laughing, and then they hit you with something so British films, where they hit you with something so heavy that it's so much more effective, and it's so much more like life, like everything's great, and then whew, you know, something crazy happens, and that's just I just love the way it's just kind of gritty, and it's just more in tune with life, I think.
Interesting. Yeah, certainly British humor is has a category all its own.
Definitely. Fighting.
Yeah, it can be.
It's one of those things I find that you know, if you're not accustomed to it, you could go out to a party or something and someone says something to you. And then a couple days later, you're like, oh man, did he ever zing me with that? And I didn't realize it until now. You know?
Right. Yeah. That repartee of, like, yeah, Winston Churchill kind of humor.
Yeah. I feel like it's very important in British society that it's sort of like, I would go as far to say that it determines your stature. Someone who's very witty probably is more successful in business and in life. It seems to be a currency there. You know,
okay,
I mean? It's
interesting.
Very important, I think.
Yeah, you were talking about humor movies, British humor, American humor, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know, one movie where this all came together, it was A Fish Called Wanda. You remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
Where they sort of take the best of British and the best of American humor and pretty successfully pull it off by, you know, imposing, you kind of have the stereotypes duel it out.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's an interesting point. I mean, there's nothing really serious about the movie, though.
No, that's just the thing. I was reminded of that whenever.
No, it was interesting fusion of, you know, British and American culture. It was really interesting, actually.
And then the CIA figure, I mean, the ex-CIA guy who was the villain, so to speak.
Yeah.
He just reminded me of that when he's making fun of British and he's like, English contribution to world cuisine, the chip. And he holds up a French fry.
Right. I mean, fish and chips, is that British, technically?
I hate to pop the bubble here, but originated in Portugal.
Okay.
Fish and chips originates when Spain or Portugal? Jeez, I cannot remember. I think it had to be Spain. Spain expelled all non-Christians in 1492, including Jews and Muslims and anyone else who was not Catholic. Oh, I guess there wouldn't have been Protestants at that point in time. That's a couple decades down the road. A lot of them went to England.
Mm-hmm.
People like David Ricardo is a descendant of one of these guys, but they brought with them their custom of eating fish, and it catches on as fish and chips in the UK, mm-hmm. what will become the UK eventually.
Right.
Because they were just busy with their boiled cabbage and they realized that, you know, this actually tastes pretty good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, thank goodness they finally discovered Indian food, because I think without it, British food would be pretty bad. That's definitely, well, it's pretty like curries in the, you know. Curries in the UK are just like hot dogs in America. Take that diss.
Uh-oh. Yeah, it's... Yeah, world cuisine's good. And I think a lot of people that aren't exposed to it don't know what they're missing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. I don't know about Canada. I suspect it's more or less the same. But you can't go to a Nowheresville small town in the U.S. without a Chinese restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they are everywhere. It caught on. Although they did adapt the food to American taste. It's candied and fatty, and they don't eat this, but yeah. they'll call it this.
One thing that's really funny in Canada, and I'm guessing you don't have this where you are, but in the small towns, the one Chinese food restaurant in each town, it always says Chinese and Canadian food.
Right.
So it's like, don't worry, if you don't like Chinese, you can still get a hamburger. and it's still like that. I think that's so funny that I guess they were worried that, I mean, it's like, that's interesting. Maybe it's sort of like a reflection of a racism that still exists or something like that.
I can remember seeing those in Canada.
Yeah.
But no, definitely not here.
Yeah.
It's Chinese
and American food.
You do not see that.
No, it's very
there's
odd.
No need. Yeah. That's definitely a cultural difference there.
Yeah.
You said hamburger for Canadian food. Tom, that's ours, buddy. Come on, poutine or something like that.
Whoa, don't call it.
Yeah, Putin. Yeah, poutine. All right, what's Canadian cuisine then? I'm curious. What can we call uniquely Canadian?
Ooh.
Okay, poutine, obviously.
Poutine,
that's
for sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to claim grandeur on this one. I'm not. I think we're too young a country to really have anything. I think you guys are mostly ripping off other cultures also. But the hamburger, doesn't the hamburger come from Hamburg?
Not when it became a victory burger, it didn't, in World War I. There you go.
That sounds a little shoddy to me.
Yeah, no, it's true, though. What's American cuisine? I guess you could say cornbread. That'd be the best thing I could come up with
grits?
Off the top of my head.
Is grits American?
Grits, yeah, it's from the South. That's wheat pone. Cream of wheat. I mean, that's basically grits.
Yeah.
People talk bad about grits. Grits are pretty good.
Yeah.
So you're right. There's a lot of borrowing and theft and everything else going on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for Canada, obviously, too, and maybe even to more. Yeah. I can't think of a lot of things really that are, I think we have twists on things, but.
And that's basically what anybody has to a certain extent.
True. What's funny is you get into the battles about, for example, if you ask a Ukrainian and a Polish person who invented the pierogi, watch out.
Fur will fly.
Yes.
Same, yeah. That's interesting as well. Yeah, food. Yeah, I mean, food seems mundane, but it there's a lot of, if you start going into stuff like that, then it gets to be quite profound.
Yeah, one thing I find really interesting about food and culture is how often the people who bring the tradition from their home country, it's more important for them to preserve it. And so they, you know what I mean? Like they hold on to the traditional way of making it, for example, way more than in the home country they even do. You know what I mean?
And they try to bring the exact ingredients,
yes, exactly,
and stuff like that.
More than, and then in the home country, they don't care as much about, you know, keeping that tradition exactly how it's always been. I guess that's just kind of trying to preserve your culture that you had to move away from for whatever reason.
Well, I remember seeing an interview with Philip Chevron of the Pogues. Was that his name?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, he died a few years back, but in the interview, he said the Pogues couldn't have happened in Ireland. It had to be in the diaspora.
Yes.
It had to be in somewhere like London,
yes,
where they're creating Irishness.
Yes. Also, not to mention that it's so funny because if you watch any footage of, in particular, the Sex Pistols, but also the Clash, any punk rock bands from that era, Shane McGowan is in every single bit of footage you'll see. He's always there.
He's at every show.
He always is there. He's at all the shows. He's going to all the shows. So, and that's the thing about the Pogues too, right? That there's definitely a punk element to them. It wasn't just traditional Irish music. They put a whole different spin on it, and probably that wouldn't have happened if they'd stayed in Ireland. They needed to go somewhere like that to put those two things together, but also to have the appreciation for it, because in Ireland, they would be like, oh, you're bastardizing this probably, or whatever, you know?
Or just, they wouldn't care that much about it. Size mile, what's a euro? It's an interesting phenomenon, to be sure.
Yeah.
Oh, well, but just back to food for a second. I remember I was living in Mexico City in the late 90s, and lo and behold, they opened a Taco Bell in downtown Mexico, center of Mexico City.
Okay.
Finally, authentic Mexican food in Mexico. You'd think it wasn't possible, but now you've got it. It lasted about 6 months before the doors closed,
okay,
and everyone just sort of laughed at it.
Yeah.
Curiously, about 20 years later, they reopened it, and it became all the rage.
Really?
Hmm. Yeah, and the explanation was, it's like, well, this isn't Mexican food for real, but it's good.
Okay.
And so they just accepted it as something other than...
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, it's like a beautiful sort of comparison of what we're doing with these songs, right? It you know, in a certain era, these songs would not become hits. And so it's interesting just to note, it's the same kind of thing, right? Where the time is so important to these little movements, regardless of what they are.
Yeah, several things have to come together.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
To make for a hit song from Mars.
Thanks for tuning in to TNT's Hit Songs from Mars. We hope you enjoyed yourself and learned a few things along the way.
For a complete list of songs you heard in this episode, visit us at hsfm.buzzsprout.com. We hope you'll support the artists we featured by purchasing their music.
If you liked this episode, please subscribe to the podcast and you'll receive new episodes as soon as they become available.
We've been recording all winter and spring and have many more surprising hit songs to share with you.
While you're at it, if you could give us a rating or review wherever you get your podcast, that would really help us out. We would like to thank The Reverb Syndicate for providing the theme song for our podcast. They have an extensive catalog of tunes just as rockin' as the one you hear here.
Hear, hear.
You can find them at thereverbsyndicate.ca and on Facebook, SoundCloud, and Bandcamp, which typically pays artists the most. We would also like to thank Eric Minot for designing our podcast icon. You can find his design and illustration work on Instagram at MinoGraphics. That's MinoGraphics. @PHX. You can connect with us on Twitter @SongsFromMars and at hsfm.buzzsprout.com.
Feel free to disagree, praise, correct, and chastise us.
We would also love to hear your idea of a hit song from Mars and why you think it fits the mold. Even better, if you felt like recording a voice memo and sending it our way, you can email us at hitsongsfrommars@gmail.com. We may even feature it on the show. Until next time, Earthlings.